It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Okay, we're joined here today with a guest. It's originally from Turkey, now lives in the United States, that has spent time in Kurdistan, goes back and forth, and has their ear to the ground in this situation. We're going to be picking their brain about what's going on in Rojava, about the military invasion of the region by the Turkish state, and we're going to be asking them some pretty in-depth, hard-hitting questions. They're somebody that we really respect as far as what they have to say about what's going on in the area. They're going to remain anonymous, but we're just going to go ahead and get started. And the first question is, you know, most listeners listening to this podcast are probably well aware, more or less, of what's going on. But can you briefly describe what Rojava is and its significance, especially in terms of what it means for anti-authoritarians and anarchists?
Just to give kind of the basic Wikipedia version, Rojava is kind of the northern stretch of Syria, all from the eastern border to the western border of Syria in the very north, and so it basically traverses all of Syria's border with Turkey, and in Kurdish it means west. And this is significant because Rojava is also an area where, since 2012, the Kurdish movement, which has been active in that region for decades, has claimed space for themselves, their ideas, and for other peoples of the region, and declared autonomy. So it is this huge stretch of northern Syria where, since 2012, the Kurdish movement has declared autonomy, and most people, listeners, might know Rojava through the images and videos, stories of the YPG and the YPJ, who are the Kurdish fighters that have been on the front lines in the battle against ISIS in Syria. So basically in 2012, kind of as the Syrian uprising descended into a civil war for various reasons, which we don't have time to get into right now, the Kurds in the north saw this as an opportunity to take control where they have lived in for many, many decades, and assert their autonomy from the Assad government. It started actually in Afrin, where the conflict is right now, and spread quickly to Kobani and all the way to the eastern end of Rojava, to Kamishlo. And they saw this opening, and they took control. And they come from a long tradition, the PYD, which is kind of the main political force that initiated this project, comes from a leftist tradition of Kurdish resistance, which actually originated across the border in the north in Turkey. The Kurdistan Workers Party, known by its initials, the PKK. So in the late 60s and 70s, a number of Kurdish and Turkish members of the student movement in Turkey really saw that the people of Kurdistan were being hyper-exploited, and there was this kind of internal colony to Turkey within its borders, and they started an armed resistance movement called the PKK in the 70s, and started a guerrilla war against the Turkish government, the Turkish state. And for decades, 40 years, this has been going on. And there was a lot of, all of this arose from within Turkey. There was a lot of cross-border kind of communication and travel and camps with Syria, because Syria also has its own Kurdish population. And I don't want to assume, but maybe probably most of the listeners know about the Kurds. They are a group of people, ethnic group of people, which have been kind of torn apart by the borders of Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. So Kurdish peoples live across all of these countries. And most of the great majority lives within Turkey. But then, of course, in northern Iraq, people know about the Kurdish regional government there and the Peshmerga, which is armed force, and in Syria also, and Iran. So the PKK launches a armed movement in the 70s. This history of this the Kurdish movement arising from the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK. There is a lot of cross-border fighting and munitions going back and forth, and camps and recruits, and the PKK ideology and the ideas of Abdullah Öcalan really take hold in northern Syria, and it becomes one of their strongholds. So the PYD really comes out of this liberatory, this tradition of like leftist liberation that really is maybe something of the past, and we'll talk about that in a second, and the ideas of Öcalan. And they start, I think around 2003 or sometime around that, the PYD starts. And this is after Öcalan is apprehended, by the way, in 99, in kind of this international operation to catch him. And ultimately they apprehend him via Kenya. So in 2012, the PYD and its armed wing, the YPG and the YPJ, which is the all-woman counterpart to the YPG, take control of three separate regions alongside the north, three separate cantons, they call them. The easternmost canton is Qamishlo, the central canton is Kobani, and the westernmost canton is Afrin, which is under Turkish invasion right now. They quickly come underneath the attack by ISIS, who at this time is in control of a large chunk of Iraq and Syria. Right now we're talking about 2013. And the city of Kobani comes under attack during the summer of 2013. And a lot of people might have heard of the battle for Kobani. It lasted months through the fall. Many battles are fought. And during this time, an alliance is forged with the United States and U.S. aerial support, and the fighting of the Kurdish fighters on the ground lead to the liberation of Kobani. And after that, the Kurds they advanced again with a lot of U.S. support, aerial bombardment, military advisors on the ground, arming them, and they push out ISIS from Syria. And they're actually able to connect the two cantons in the very east, the one of Qamishlo, and in the center, the one of Kobani, and create a vast stretch under their control. So the question I think that you asked, which brings us kind of to today, which we'll talk about later, but the question of the significance for anti-authoritarians, it's important to really note that, you know, the YPG, PYD, the PKK, they're not really anti-authoritarian formations. They're not anarchists. They have hierarchical structures. And, you know, they don't really demonstrate this idealized organization that some of us maybe dream of. But at the same time, I personally think that there's a genuine desire, at least from the people within the movement, maybe not from the kind of old ideologue leadership that comes from this, you know, authoritarian left tendency, but from a lot of the volunteers, the activists, the younger youth within the Kurdish movement. There's the genuine a desire to kind of like reinvent the movement in a more anti-authoritarian and horizontal form without completely disqualifying all of the tradition and the sacrifices that have brought them to this moment. So, you know, somebody who has these conversations, I think it's genuine that there are these rigid hierarchies, but there's also a desire to reinvent themselves. And also another thing that I think is important and relevant is that it's a movement of a ethnic and cultural identity, without a question. You know, the Kurdish people were prevented from speaking their own language, both in Turkey still to a degree, and in Syria. So, and even exhibiting their traditional colors, clothes, their songs. So it's definitely assertion of a cultural identity, but at the same time, it doesn't really get stuck in that, and it tries to be very pluralistic in various ways. You know, when the Kurdish forces in northern Syria talk about Syria, they always talk about all of the different ethnic groups, about the diversity and maintaining that. And there is a desire to have representation in the councils and communes that they have of the different ethnic groups. In Turkey, where the Kurdish political forces put together different political parties, there is this emphasis of diversity on race and sexuality and gender. And, almost sometimes it could be at the detriment to, you know, maybe a little more class struggle that some of us might want to, but so although it's identity based, it's also very very much for a pluralistic diversity. And also it's important that there was this to mention that there was this turn to kind of a deep critique of the state. So there is, you know, it used to be this national liberation movement, and there's still tension that arises from that history, but now there is this idea that it's an anti-statist movement, and much more for forms, different federative forms of organizing society, different confederations and collectives and communes, and like a desire to imagine a way of organizing society that does not fall into these centralized structures. Is also, I think, interesting for us anti-authoritarians.
Right. Well, turning to last weekend, Turkey launched a major military assault against the Afrin region of Rojava. Can you speak to how that came about and what are the latest developments?
So Erdogan has been threatened by what's been going on in northern Syria since the beginning, and has really looked for an opening to launch a full-on attack on Rojava and the political project there. So this is kind of comes as the final move in more smaller scale aggressions against the Kurdish movement in the north. There's been continuous shelling, obviously, across the border occasionally, but, you know, more insidiously maybe, Turkey really used that border with Syria, with Rojava, as a way of facilitating the transfer of both Islamist insurgents into Syria, which come underneath different names. Sometimes they're the Free Syrian Army, sometimes Al-Nusra, sometimes they're ISIS, and at the same time sending arms, which have been documented with photographs of these semi-trucks going from Turkey into Syria. So there's been this continuous level of proxy wars and wars against the Kurds, because obviously an autonomous region in northern Syria provides a kind of a base and the first implementation of this long-standing dream that Kurds around the region have had of autonomy. So it's very inspiring. At the same time, it's territory that the Kurdish movement controls and can put into practice a lot of their ideas and experiments, organize out of militarily. So it's a huge threat to the kind of nationalist Turkish projects, which attempts to repress the Kurds within its own borders. So has been aggressions from Erdogan and the AKP, the Turkish state, for a while. And, you know, the, for example, the connecting of all three cantons was a big threat to them. And to prevent that, they launched the operation called Euphrates Shield and took the territory between Afrin and Kobani, kind of cutting Afrin off. And now they want to take all of Afrin. And they say that they're going to continue, that it's not just about the west of the Euphrates, that they will go all the way to the east of the Euphrates as well. So the Turkish military launched an assault 6 days ago against Afrin, the westernmost canton. And what they did was they used dozens and dozens of fighter jets and bombed the villages and YPG positions in those villages out on the near the border. And then they basically started bussing in what they call the Free Syrian Army, but just are a hodgepodge of different Islamist units and militias that comprise the Free Syrian Army, whatever that might be. But first of all, it's interesting. These fighters, apparently hundreds and hundreds of them, were somewhere in Turkey being trained, being housed, who knows what. And so they have entered Turkey and are, entered Syria, entered Rojava from Turkey, and are trying to take territory and get closer and closer to the city of Afrin, which is, not exactly sure, but it's kind of in the center of the canton. And there has been, the past 3 days, there's been heavy fog, which has kind of prevented the operation from progressing. But, you know, the YPG and YPJ members have also been keeping them at bay. And so there's four or five different locations from the borders that they're trying to enter from. And it's unclear what the actual goal of this, because there's contradictory statements. One time the prime minister of Turkey will say, oh, we're just going to go 30 kilometers in. Another time they'll say, we're going to cleanse Afrin from the terrorists, or, you know, so it's unclear what exactly the goal is. But I think it's going to continue for a while, and they will definitely be met with some fierce Kurdish resistance, if history is to say anything about it.
What do you think Turkey wants to come out of this aggression? Is it just to totally wipe Kurdish resistance off the map? Are they trying to push back just a little bit? What do you think that they're actually trying to do with this entire military operation?
I think for sure if they had their way, they would try to wipe Rojava off the map and put in their own proxies or occupy it outright. But will they be able to do that? That's still unclear. I mean, the thing with Manbij is that it's actually it's connected to the other two cantons, right? The center canton of Kobani and Komishlo. And also there are US forces there. And there's a lot more armament of the YPG. The fact that Afrin was isolated and separate from the rest of Rojava really makes it much easier to invade and launch a military assault against. And the kind of foreign imperialist power in Afrin were actually the Russian military. And they had an agreement with Turkey, and they pulled out of the operational area that Turkey was going to conduct this operation in. And actually the Kurds in Afrin and Rojava see the Russians as just as complicit as, you know, as Turkey in what's happening right there. Because they really see that Russia is coming into some kind of backdoor deal with Turkey and just selling them out, even though they have been allies and they have actually conducted operations together in Aleppo and other places as well. So the Kurds are are very upset at the Russian force on the ground. And it's unclear if Turkey would be able to also make some kind of agreement with the U.S. to go after Palm Beach, but they would have to, for sure. You know, it's really kind of there's no real use in speculating. We'll just have to wait and see.
The night our eyes changed. Rooms where love was made and unmade in a flash of the night. Rooms where memories drowned in fumes of poison. Rooms where futures were planned and the imagination of children built castles in the sky. Rooms where both the extraordinary and the mundane were lived, become forever tortured graves of ash. Oh, you political class, so servile to corporate power.
Justice, not hear him scream.
Did they die or us? Did they die or us? Did they die for
this corporate manslaughter will haunt you, not hear him scream.
Words cannot express, please allow me to begin though. 1:30 a.m. heard the shouting from my window. People crying in the street, watching the burning of their kinfolk. Grenfell Tower now, historically a symbol. People reaching from their windows, screaming for their lives, pleading with their cries, trying to reason with the skies. They all youth birth champions. Comparison is clear though, that every single person in that building was a hero. So don't judge our tired eyes in these trying times, cause we've been breathing in cyanide the entire night. They say Yassin saw the fire and he ran inside. Who thought that would be the site where he and his family died? The street is like a graveyard, tombstone lurching over us. Those shouting out to their windows, now wish they never woke them up. Wouldn't hope your worst enemy to go in this position. Now it's flowers for the dead and printing posters for the missing. Come home.
Justice, not hear him scream.
Did they die or us? Did they die or us? Did they die for
this corporate manslaughter will haunt you, not hear him scream.
See trauma in the faces of all those that witness this innocence, in the faces of all those on the missing list. See hopes unfulfilled, ambitions never achieved. No, I'm not the only one that sees the dead in my dreams. Strive for the bravery of Yassin, artistic gift of Khadija. Every person a unique blessing to never be repeated. Strive for the loyalty of siblings that stay behind with their parents. Pray that every loved one lost can somehow make an appearance. We are like the last conversation with their dearest. Until we face what they face, we will never know what fear is. We are for survivors, rehoused in the best place, not to be left sleeping in the West Way for 10 days. We're for arrests made and debts paid and true numbers known, for the families who kept faith. We're for safety and homes of love. They are immortalized forever. The only ghosts are us. I wonder.
Justice, not hear him scream.
Did they die or us? Did they die or us? Did they die for
this corporate manslaughter will haunt you, not hear him scream.
قلولي وين اروح الناس تحترق بيسات السحور. احس اني بعالم تاني, احس اني بعالم تاني. قلولي وين اروح ناس تحترق بساعات السحور. أحس إني بعالم تاني, أحس إني بعالم تاني.
To whom it may concern, at the Queen's Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, where is Yassin al-Wahhabi? Where is his brother Mehdi? Where is his sister Noor Huda? Where is their mother? And where is their father?
Where is Noura Jamal? Where is her husband, Hashim?
Where is their children, Yahya, Firdaus, and Yaqub?
Where is Nadia Lumeda?
Where is Steve Power?
Where is Dennis Murphy?
Where is Marco Gottardi?
Where is Gloria Trevisan?
Where is Amal and her daughter Amaya?
Where is Mohammed Nada?
Where is Al-Yawar Ja'fari? Where is Khadija Sayyid?
Where is Maryam Al-Gawari?
Where is her mother Sua?
Tell us. Where is Rania Ibrahim and her two daughters?
Where is Jessica Ubano Ramirez?
Where is Deborah Lamprell?
Where is Mohammed Al-Hajj Ali?
Where is Nadia? Where is her husband Basim?
Where are her daughters, Mina, Fatima, and Zainab, and their grandmother?
Where is Zainab Deen,
her son Jeremiah?
Where is Liga Yang? Where is she?
Where is Mohammed Nur Tuku?
Where is Tony Dissi?
Where is Maria Bird?
Where is Fataya Al Sanusi?
Where is your son Abu Faraz?
Her daughter.
Where is Lucas James?
Where is Farah Hamdan?
Where is Omar Belkhadi?
Where is their daughter, Lina?
Where is Hamid Khani?
Where is Hesham Rahman?
Where is Raymond Bernard?
Where is Isaac Powell?
Where is Marjorie Vital?
And your son,
what is Kumar Mia?
Where is his wife, Raz?
Where are their children, Abdul Hanif?
Abdul Hamid and Hosna?
Where are Sakina and Fatima?
Where is Burki Habtoum and her son, Baru?
Tell us.
Where is Stefan and Tina?
Where is Abdel Salam?
Where is Khadija Khalif?
Where is Karen Bernard?
Where are these people?
Where are these people?
Where is Gary Maunders?
Where is Ramina Begum Aliam?
Where is her 6-year-old daughter, Mariam?
Her 5-year-old daughter, Hafiz.
And her 3-year-old son, Mohammed. God bless you all.
Where are these people? Where are these people?
There'll be ashes on your graves. Like a phoenix, we will rise. The blood is on your hands. There'll be ashes on your grave. Like a phoenix, we will rise.
Well, we want to turn now to the relationship between the Rojavan forces and the U.S. I think this has been on the minds of a lot of people lately. But Rojava's YPG and YPJ militias are the main groups comprising the Syrian Democratic Forces, as you mentioned before, which has maintained a tactical alliance with the United States in fighting ISIS. Yet now we see nothing but empty words coming from the U.S. as Turkey attacks its supposed allies, which is especially troubling as Turkey used the U.S.'s bungled announcement of creating an SDF border force as a pretext for invading Rojava. What are your thoughts on this and what lessons should be drawn from it?
The U.S. definitely used the Syrian Democratic Forces as a way to fight ISIS. And, you know, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the YPG and YPJ, definitely needed the U.S. air power to be able to save Kobani and push ISIS out. So, you know, maybe we might never know what happened behind the scenes, but they definitely needed each other. And I think most people knew that it was going to come down to this moment where these uneasy alliances that had been forged were kind of going to come to a head, and, you know, the Kurdish movement was going to find itself without a lot of friends in this international geopolitical nation state structure. So that doesn't really come very surprising. And, you know, in the meantime, they got a bunch of weapons from the U.S. But I think if the U.S. had to be put in the choice between losing Turkey as an ally or going along with these, you know, ex-leftist, quasi-anarchists, or at least supported by anarchists around the world, confederative, democratic fighting force, they would probably keep Turkey as an ally. And I think Turkey is actually trying to force the U.S.'s hand a little bit, and seeing how far that relationship goes. And, you know, it's important to remember that there's a massive U.S. air base in southern Turkey that's been there for more than half a century. So that's one thing. And one speculation has actually been that maybe the U.S. is trying to hedge its bets and establish some kind of other base. And maybe that base is in northern Iraq, northern Syria, you know, kind of nestled between the Kurdish regional government and Rojava. Another, I think, thing development recently is that, you know, with the entrance of Trump, There has been a little bit of confusion of what the U.S.'s official position is in terms of the Kurdish forces in Syria, because it seems like maybe Trump is not so gung-ho about supporting the Kurds, but it's just me going along with this military Obama period policy of these, you know, people on the ground in Rojava advising the Kurds and calling in airstrikes and these envoys to the YPG and etc. And there's already this relationship built that is maybe like the only strategy that is in play and needs to be maintained, because there's continuously contradictory kind of statements coming from Trump and then from the Pentagon. And this is actually happening a lot right now as this operation talking is happening.
So if we were to log on to a website like the World Socialist website, which is Trotskyist, hates anarchists, of course, but, you know, if you read their articles about the pushing out of ISIS from the city of Raqqa, what they would say is that, you know, the YPG and the YPJ are all puppets of U.S. imperialism, and that there's been a horrible massacre of people in the city of Raqqa, and like all these groups are complicit. I'm just curious, you know, how you would respond to that.
I mean, I don't think they're puppets, but I think that there is some kind of agreement that they must have come to have a military alliance, right? It's just kind of the basic nature of war. But I think very soon those people are going to realize that they're not puppets, and I think what we're seeing right now is the kind of opening chapters of the Kurds just being left to themselves once again. But in terms of the massacres, you know, I mean, I think that, for example, what happened in Aleppo was pretty insane. And basically, you know, if you have aerial bombardment, you're gonna have a lot of civilian casualties, and I definitely don't believe, and I don't think there's any proof that YPG, YPJ, SDF forces kind of commit massacres, as in, you know, go into a town and execute people. They definitely don't enslave people the way that ISIS does, and they don't indiscriminately bomb areas. You know, I think a lot of critique that I've heard is about kind of like moving populations, and that's seen as kind of changing the demographics of an area. This is the main critique that I've heard against the kind of the Kurdish movement there. Is and you know, if there is war, you're going to have to move a population in order for massacres to not happen. And in many, many instances, they've actually invited people back, and, you know, not, you know, you're not going to be allowed. I think it's just, you know, basic common sense. If you support one of their enemies, ISIS or al-Nusra, you know, you won't be allowed to come back and conduct that activity. And I'm not sure if there's anything wrong with that, you know, just kind of like in this country, we try to stop Nazis from organizing just like that. But, you know, there's all these accusations leveled against them, even from groups like Amnesty. And, you know, there's a considerable effort to kind of demonstrate that that's not the case and invite people to see the places that the reports are about. So far, I haven't seen anything credible of kind of massacres that have been conducted by the YPG or the YPJ, but definitely I think there's been a lot of indiscriminate aerial bombardment by all of the forces with fighter jets, you know, the regime, Syrian regime, definitely Turkey going on right now, Russia, Aleppo, the United States for sure in Raqqa, you know, so, I mean, yeah, there have been massacres.
A lot of anarchist attention has been directed to international groups such as the IRPGF that are fighting in Rojava against ISIS. Are they involved in the defense of Afrin? what has been the response of radicals around the world to Turkey's invasion? What does effective solidarity, in your opinion, look like from afar?
As far as I know, the IRPGF, which is a wild acronym, is not involved in fighting and offering them. You know, and neither are a lot of other people who maybe would like to be because of its isolation, how it's cut off. And this will be one of the determining things, and maybe one of the few kind of political cards that the Kurds might be able to pull is with the Syrian regime. The Syrian regime facilitates, and maybe they will, because they're not they're enemies with the Turkish state as well. And the Free Syrian Army, if the Syrian regime facilitates the passage of YPG fighters through its territory into Afrin, that might change a lot of the forces on the ground, the balance of the forces. And there's another international brigade, actually, that is, I think, in Manbij, and they are trying to make their way to Afrin through some of the Syrian regime-controlled areas. They've been recently featured in the media and stuff. But, you know, I think right now we're starting to see a lot of demonstrations, especially in Europe and in the United States as well, in solidarity with those fighting the Turkish invasion in Afrin. And also there's been some demonstrations in front of Russian consulates because of their complicity in it. And I think that it's important, A, to kind of demonstrate to show the Kurdish movement that people are paying attention, that they're not isolated and left by themselves, at least in terms of consciousness, even if they are in Afrin. But also maybe start to build a more kind of international solidarity movement that can grow, that can be have some sort of agency by organizing demonstrations in these Western points of power that, especially when it comes to Syria, are trying to exert influence, you know, especially in the U.S. I'm not going to give advice to anti-authoritarians and radicals in Russia, but, you know, there or wherever around Europe, because the kind of the Kurdish diaspora does this, and I think it would be very beneficial to everybody if also radicals of different stripes started to organize some solidarity with the Kurdish struggle.
In many statements and actions of solidarity, we see a lot of reference to support for the Kurdish people and the Kurdish freedom struggle when it comes to Rojava. While in no way trying to discount the role of Kurds in the struggle, nor the brutal and systematic oppression that they have faced from all countries in the Middle East, it seems that the struggle project in Rojava is more than a response to Kurdish oppression, and is certainly not a nationalist project. How would you frame Rojava, and when people express solidarity, what is it they should be in solidarity with?
Kind of the most inspiring and important aspect of what's happening in Rojava and in the Kurdish movement right now is the women's liberation movement within it. You know, I mentioned the YPJ as the all-woman kind of counterpart force to the YPG, just a fighting military force. But also beyond that, there's such an emphasis on women's autonomy and liberation within the Kurdish movement. All of the political and social structures have women leadership, women's groups within them. And I think that is maybe really relevant right now to what's happening in the United States, right, where there is kind of an awakening of some sort of feminists coming, and maybe some of us are frustrated with the more like liberal, you know, get out to vote aspect that is taking hold, and we can see some different ideas of what women's liberation can look like by turning our gaze towards Rojava. So I think that's really important to always keep central. But also, yeah, it's not a nationalist project. It's a project against nation states by a group of, by a population which has been divided and repressed by a number of nation states, and right now is fighting its frontline battle in a, you know, ex-nation state underneath attack by a different imperialist and other nation states in the region fighting proxy wars with each other. So within that kind of cesspool of nation states, I think it's interesting that they're posing a different way forward. So, you know, that I think is something to definitely be in solidarity with. There is an emphasis on a different way of organizing society that is more horizontal and is based upon different councils at different levels of society, which I think is inspiring and something to learn from. There's an emphasis on ecological life and, you know, a system that doesn't just center humans, but all living things, and does not destroy kind of the natural beauty around us. So I think those are all things that a lot of us can get down with. And there is a place in the world where, you know, people with those ideas have taken control and are trying to defend that. So I think anybody who is sympathetic to those ideas should try to defend them and show solidarity. And this isn't, you know, this is something, it's a struggle that's been going on for decades, and it's sure to continue. So I hope people pay attention and, you know, at the very least go out to a solidarity demo that is happening near them and try to learn more about it.
Thanks for coming on the program. Anything else you want to say? We want to encourage people, again, go onto Facebook or do a search, find a local demonstration in your area. And I would encourage people personally, if there's a community of Kurdish people next to you, if they have like a community space or they have some sort of group, you know, connect with them, find out how you can support. But anything else you want to say?
I think all of the things that you mentioned are really important. You know, try to see if there are people organizing around your area, learn more about what's going on. There's a lot of kind of online communities around this as well, but it's really important to actually start organizing, you know, IRL real life demonstrations. I think to like I said, both to start to build a movement that can put pressure on government, the US government, as well as to show the Kurds that they are not alone and people are paying attention.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us and talk to you soon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm gonna put it on, don't you lock this close, we'll save the day. You've gonna tell no tales. Dead men. Dead men tell no tales. Dead men talk no shit. Dead men tell no tales. Dead men talk no shit. Dead men tell no tales. Dead men talk no shit. Dead men tell no tales. Dead men talk no shit.